So it fits very well to the topic from yesterday. I will try to summarize in more or less 2 hours the whole story of mixture formation for combustion engines, from carburetor to injection and direct injection and hydrogen and everything. Okay, so please feel free to ask questions. If anything is not clear, really, to ask questions. Let's start. So basically, what are the main goals of mixture formation? So we want to have the right mixture and the right amount of mixture for the proper engine function. What does it mean, the right mixture? Several things. The first, let's say, most important fact is the air-fuel ratio, or we are working in Europe more with air-excess ratio, with lambda. And we have to consider it locally and globally. If we run an engine where the intention is to run homogeneously the mixture, the right mixture is homogeneous and has the right air-fuel ratio. But there are several engines with stratified mixtures. Stratified means we have different air-excess ratios in different spots of the combustion chamber on purpose. So there was a pretty long period where we tried to realize the lean burning gasoline engine. And since a very lean mixture cannot be ignited by a spark, we need roughly stoichiometric, roughly lambda one mixtures in the vicinity of the spark plug. And it can be leaned out to the outskirts, outer areas of the combustion chamber. So, in other words, we have a required global air-fuel ratio and we have a required local air-fuel ratio. Of course, depending on the type of the engine, with gasoline engines we are always trying or intending to achieve a pre-mixed combustion. It means completely evaporated fuel. No liquid droplets. In case of diesel engines, it cannot be avoided. We can evaporate a certain amount due to pre-injections, but the most of the fuel is still in microscopic little droplets in the chamber, and it will end up in the often mentioned diffusion type combustion. Okay? So, types of mixture formation. SI, spark ignited engines. Originally, there was a carburetor, at least one in a central position, or later on with more sophisticated or more sporty or larger engines. There were carburetors for a group of cylinders or even individual, one carburetor for every cylinder. If you look at a motorbike, it's typically the mostly used solution. Are individual carburetors or individual throttle bodies for every cylinder. Later on came the central fuel injection, what replaced the carburetor. The port fuel injection was common, let's say, from the 70s to 2000 a little. And today we have typically direct injection and homogeneous, but we tried very hard for roughly 10 years in the 90s to realize well-built stratified engines with lean mixture. And here you can see some examples for direct injection. The first engines had this lateral injector position on the intake side. Later on came the vertical position, the central injector position. And today we can find both. There is no winner in this game. You can find well-built and then well-working engines with both solutions. So, in pictures, so the good old carburetor, there was a carburetor placed on the intake manifold with the Venturi. The Venturi caused some depression, and due to the depression, gasoline was mixed to the air, and that's it. And it was distributed with an intake manifold to the cylinders. Later on, came the central fuel injection, then the port fuel injection. So every cylinder had an injector very near to the intake valve, half in the manifold, half in the cylinder head, it depended, but very near. And today, in the most engines, we have the injector somewhere in the cylinder head, but it injects directly into the combustion chamber. So let's see the gasoline engines. If we look, how does the AFR changes or influences the engine function? So we can see that the maximum power is roughly at an air excess ratio of lambda 0.856, something in the vicinity. So maybe from 0.85 to 0.9, in the case of the most engines, is the maximum power. It is the maximum power if you measured the oxygen content of the exhaust gas, you would see at lambda 1 you have still roughly 0.8% oxygen. So it means you could use it if you add more fuel. And if you do this, you will reach roughly 0.2% oxygen at maximum power. And if you are going farther left, nothing happens. You cannot use the oxygen better than this percentage. Do you understand? Okay. So it's all the challenge is always to put enough air into the engine. So the amount of air, of oxygen, will define the power output at the end. And the maximum usage of oxygen is achieved normally at those figures. And the maximum usage of the fuel happens on the other side, on the lean side. And it will be the lowest amount of unburned hydrocarbons. It's the most efficient usage of the fuel itself. It's on the other side. However, today, where are all the engines running? Lambda 1, of course, because of the catalytic converter. So the three-way catalyst can only work, you have heard it already, only in this line. So theoretically, we could achieve more power or less consumption, but we wouldn't fulfill the exhaust gas emission prescriptions. It's different in case of racing engines, we will do it. So Formula 1 is running because it's a fuel-saving formula today, always with very lean mixtures, in order to achieve the lowest possible fuel consumption. With some tricks, they can go even further. As I know, they are running roughly 1.5, 1.6 lambda figures. It's extremely lean. So the good old carburetor. In the very early time, it was typical to use carburetors, upstream carburetors. And why? Because in order for a proper function of the carburetor, you need this float chamber. The fuel level in the float chamber is slightly below this point. In the normal position, and during standstill of the engine, no fuel should flow into the barrel. But typically, those cars had a fuel tank in a higher position than the carburetor, and the gravity fed the fuel to the carburetor. And this needle valve is typically a little bit not tight, not perfectly tight. And the fuel leakage flows into the carburetor, and if the engine is there, it would fill up the engine, at least one of the combustion chambers. And in the very moment you want to start the engine, you have liquid in the combustion chamber, and no more engine. So even the starter motor and the inertia of the flywheel is enough to destroy the engine if you have liquid in the chamber, because it's not compressible. It gains some speed, and the cylinder filled with liquid reaches top dead center, it cracks. Cracked piston, bent conrod, leaky head, gasket, whatever. So it's gone. But later on, the fuel tank was placed somewhere lower, and there was a fuel pump, and the fuel pump was not active during standstill. So later on, the most carburetors were downstream carburetors or horizontal carburetors for racing applications in order to achieve a lower hood line of the engine in flat, sporty cars. So just to repeat it, laminar and turbulent flow, hopefully you remember. Laminar flow, the flow lines are never crossing. You have no perpendicular component to the walls. It's always parallel. just like sliding papers, one on the other. Turbulent flow is a wild mixture. You have crossing lines of flow. And typically it happens at higher speed, above a certain Reynolds number. Reynolds number depends on velocity, diameter, and kinematic viscosity of the medium. And in the most cases, we have turbulent flows in engines. In case, let's say, of a carburetor or fuel injection, it is fine because one to achieve a mixture. It's far, far better to have a turbulent flow to prepare the mixture already in the manifold. And turbulent flow is better for us, for example, in heat exchangers, in the coolant, and everywhere where we require a high heat transfer coefficient. Because in this case, just imagine, this is the water jacket of a cylinder block, and you want that the cold water cools the cylinder liner. And if the layers are not mixing, the cooling effect is very poor, because there is as a hot layer near to the surface, it becomes hot at the beginning, and this had more and more temperature, and there is less and less heat transfer from the metal into the liquid. If it is turbulent, you will replace always the hot water on the surface by colder one from the middle, and you have a far better heat transfer coefficient. So it's very, very important to have in cooling jackets and in radiators, heat exchangers, turbulent flow. And if it will not happen on its own, there will produce some wavy surfaces, some little rips or whatever to generate the turbulences, the vortexes. And the flow speed, in case of laminar flow, there is a strong difference in speeds. In case of turbulent, you have only a so-called laminar boundary layer, it's very thin, and the most of the cross-section has a very similar speed. Okay, so the carburetor. Again, in the first attempt, you have seen the flow chamber with a slightly lower fuel level than this point in the venturi of the barrel of the carburetor. And the most important functions every car carburetor requires is, of course, a calibrated main fuel jet. It will control the dosage of the fuel. And since there are processes on second power of the airspeed, the mixture would be more and more rich with rising airspeed in the carburetor. So it's not good. We want to have the same mixture all the time. And the people invented a second jet, is the main air jet or brake air jet, which breaks the fuel flow. And with the ratio of the two jets, we can typically achieve a pretty well-balanced mixture all the time with some other tricks. And in the case we are suddenly opening the throttle valve, the following happens. Just imagine you have a carburetor in the long intake manifold, made from metal, from aluminium. So the walls of this manifold are not very hot, of course. The fuel is coming from the carburetor barrel into this manifold. And some part of the fuel will be condensed on the walls. On the wall, the fuel is going towards the cylinders, but far slower than the air. You are with me? Okay. If the speed is unchanged, nothing happens, because at the end, all the air will go into engine and all the fuel. So the mixture is unchanged. But if you suddenly open the throttle, the air will accelerate immediately. And the fuel is still going very slow on the walls. So it will lean out, and the engine will misfire, sometimes even stop. You will accelerate, and it stops. So people added a little pump, and this little pump injected through a jet in a second tube some fuel in case of acceleration. It was the acceleration pump. Some of them worked with a membrane, others with a piston, doesn't matter, the same function. And during the sudden opening of the throttle, some additional fuel was added. Of course, if we decelerate, if we are suddenly closing the throttle, you can imagine the opposite happens. we have too much fuel on the walls of the intake manifold, and it will go into the engine. So it will enrich the mixture for a few seconds. We will have high emissions and high fuel consumption without any use. But with the carburetor, we cannot avoid it. So in transient mode, opening the throttle is typically leaning out. And we have to put in a device against this leaning out, because the drivability of the car is important. During deceleration, we will always have an emission peak. So since that, you can see carburetor will not be the dream solution for a catalyst. Other stories, just imagine you have a carburetor and the car is driving from the right to the left and the flow chamber is behind the carburetor. Due to the acceleration, the fuel level is tilted and the relative distance to this point is increased. So acceleration will lean out the mixture. And if you are tipping on the brake, deceleration will enrich the mixture. So the minimum that you put the flow chamber in the front of the carburetor, in the direction of driving, that you have an enrichment for acceleration is good for more power. And the leaning out during deceleration, you do not need the fuel, as a matter of fact. You understand? So these were the mechanical tricks. Today we are programming the computer and doing it with an electronic control unit. But earlier, all these stories must be solved with mechanical thinking and fluid dynamics and with all these stories. Of course, for racing, this carburetor type is not really good. So people invented the carburetor you have seen yesterday, the DCOA, where the flow chamber is more or less symmetrically around the barrel on both sides. And this point where the fuel is going in is in the middle of the flow chamber, because it's a split flow chamber on both sides. So there's no relative change of the fuel level for the barrel of the carburetor. It's very, very tricky. So it was the solution in the 50s and 60s. And fuel injection, all types in one. In the very moment the three-way catalyst came in, it requires a HEGO sensor and a lambda control. It requires lambda one. And people, carburetor companies, tried to that time to build a device in the carburetor to regulate the main fuel jet and to control the mixture based on the signal of the HEGO sensor. But, okay, so it was a mess. So at the end, a central injector replaced the carburetor, and the people were very, very happy to have injection, this little label on their cars, and fantastic, it's surely better. And as a matter of fact, it was not better. But the central fuel injection had only the benefit, it was easy to control with the HEGO sensor, because you control the amount of fuel with pulse width. They open it, close it, and the opening time of the injector will define the fuel flow. It's very easy to control. But the carburetor made a better mixture. It was a better atomization of the fuel than this injector. So since that, the fuel consumption and the power were not increased with the central injection. Absolutely not. But next time, even harder emission regulations required an absolutely even distribution of the mixture. Because just imagine an inline four or maybe an inline six engine with one single injector. You have a long intake manifold, you have G-forces, acceleration, deceleration, and different bends of the tubes and different lengths and surfaces. You will never ever have the same mixture in every cylinder and not even the same volumetric efficiency. So it's far better to build an intake manifold with equal runner lengths, with one planum, and to dose the fuel individually directly in the port of the cylinder head. And it was the winning system, beginning with typically Euro 2, 3, up to Euro 6, maybe even Euro 7 could be done that way. What's the trick? The trick is that we always try to inject the fuel onto the backside of the hot and closed intake valve. We should never ever inject fuel into the cylinder during opening of the valve, because this fuel will go in form of droplets into the cylinder, and it's not well premixed. if it evaporates from the hot surface of the intake valve, it's good. So it was the best possible solution. So the engine control unit was built in a way that the closing time of the injector was defined, by the factory defined. It was always closing before the intake valve opens. And if you required a larger amount of fuel, the opening was advanced. Advanced and retarded opening, but what you could influence with programming it. But the closing point was always fixed. Yes? Oh, it's a very good question. This is more than the whole electronic story. The injection and the spark both are an issue, because earlier there was a mechanical distributor, and it was a mechanical link between camshaft and ignition distributor. And always the cylinder on firing TDC fired. Later on, you had an electronic device with maybe four ignition coils, and the marking on the flywheel or on the pulley can tell you only let's talk about a four-cylinder engine. You have the information that cylinder number one and four are in TDC, but you don't know which one is firing. So there were engines not knowing this, and they injected the fuel more or less simultaneously in both cylinders. So there are funny pictures. I do not know it if I have it today, but and some of the engines fired the spark even in both cylinders. But let's say a spark a few degrees before top dead center during exhaust, nothing happens. Some electric wear on erosion of the spark plug, but nothing functional. And later on, a camshaft position sensor came in, and it told you which cylinder should fire. So typically, you can observe it. If you know older cars with carburetor and distributor, the most time it was enough to kick the key and the engine was running. And later engines, you have to turn the key, and worst case, to wait two rotations of the crankshaft to have finally the first signal of the camshaft due to the ratio 1:2 camshaft crankshaft. Two rotations and it started to fire. Because the ECU had to learn every time, needed the information, where is the engine? Number four is firing or number one? Okay, are you with me? Okay. So, single point injection was the next solution compared to the carburetor. It was independent from G-forces, acceleration. It could be controlled with a lambda sonda, lambda HEGO sensor. But it was the same issue with the unequal length of the runners, distribution of the mixture and air. And the wall wetting was even worse because the atomization of the fuel was not good as in case of the carburetor. So the trick you have seen at the beginning, I told you this air jet in calibrated air jet in the carburetor, mixed air to the fuel even before the barrel. So it came out as in form of a foam. So it was very easy to atomize by the high-speed airflow. And it was not so good with these injectors. And now the port injection, you had a fuel gallery, a singular individual injector for every cylinder. And if you have done a good job, you modify the manifold in a way that the runners were straight and equally long. So it gave far less wall wetting. The whole intake manifold, there was no more wall wetting. So in case of acceleration, there was a little enrichment necessary, but far less than with the central injection or carburetor. And during deceleration, the amount of fuel which went useless into the engine was reduced as well. It was not completely gone, but significantly reduced. So at the end, better transient response because we are nearer to the chamber, improved engine dynamics, acceleration, better power due to the well-designed intake manifold, better volumetric efficiency, injector operation. Later on, it was synchronized with the camshaft, and we exactly avoided to inject into the open valve. And at the end, we had more power, lower emissions, and lower fuel consumption. So it was a big step. Here you can see the control unit will regulate it with the pulse width. The position and the targeting is in a way that we try to inject everything onto the hot surface of the intake valve. And this was a surprise. It helped us a lot to keep the intake valves clean. It was like a gasoline shower in every cycle. And as direct injection came in, there were serious issues with coking, with deposits, and sometimes with blocked intake ports. It was completely filled with carbon deposits because there were no more fuel shower to clean it. And at the end, central or side position direct injection allows us opened a lot of opportunities. And this was the key to introduce turbocharging widely, nearly for every gasoline engine, because as a side effect, we learned that the knocking behavior of the engine was improved. So with direct injection, we can have a far higher compression ratio or higher boost pressure, and the risk of knocking combustion is significantly reduced. So this story allowed us the downsizing at the end, small gasoline engines with high boost pressures. Of course, we absolutely do not need any enrichment for acceleration, so the transient behavior is fantastic. We can, let's say, just imagine in some carburetors there was a device to close the fuel jets in case of deceleration, to avoid any fuel consumption, useless fuel consumption during deceleration. But the carburetor was far away from the engine, so typically a small electronic device had to switch back the fuel with a dropping engine speed roughly at 1400 RPM. Otherwise, if you opened the clutch, it was too late, then the engine was killed because the fuel couldn't reach to fill up the manifold, all this wall wetting, you have to build it up again. So you had to restart the injection at a far higher speed than idle speed of the engine. With direct injection, if you want to fire the next cycle, you start injection and it will fire. So it's absolutely no safety margin necessary. Even more interesting, typically a four-cylinder engine, you can start it without a starter motor. We made several experiments and some companies intended to introduce it in volume production to avoid starter motor. Because one cylinder is in a position, closed valves, and behind top dead center. If your ECU must be a special one, in the very moment you stop the engine, it will save the position of the crankshaft and the camshaft and knows which cylinder is in a position behind top dead center, both valves closed. If you find this cylinder, inject a little amount of fuel and make a spark little later, combustion will happen and it will kick the engine and it will start it. It's very interesting to see on the dyno, nothing happens, it starts to run. No noise, no starter motor, you know this noise of the gears and everything, nothing. On its very own, it starts to run and it's pretty reliable. But somehow all the companies were skeptical and did not realize it at the end. But it works typically already from four cylinder upwards. On the other side, we start the mixture formation very late. We have not enough time to fully evaporate the fuel. The combustion is not fully premixed, and we will have, what will we have? Which emission? Not evaporated fuel, liquid droplets. Little, but the big issue is what we never had in case of gasoline, soot, particulates. Even the tiniest liquid fuel droplet will give you particulates. So we taught the SI engine to produce soot with a shorter time of mixture formation. the real beginning of the story was stratified mixture. So by using a well-timed injection, a special piston shape, and a specially adjusted tumble, it was a reverse tumble in case of the Mitsubishi engine, we tried to conduct the rich mixture cloud to the spark plug, and we could fire the engine. And in other spots of the combustion chamber, it was very lean. So an average mixture, 1.5, 2.2, so very lean mixtures. So for engineers, what is the biggest benefit of a lean mixture in case of a gasoline engine? Why can we save fuel? What effect causes the real fuel saving? Okay, but you have seen the lowest fuel consumption, maybe it was that the lowest amount of unburnt hydrocarbons is at lambda 1.2, 1.3 or something like this. And we are running lambda 2. So if you're leaning out, of course, for a while, you can avoid unburnt hydrocarbons. But if it's already minimum and you are going beyond, it's getting worse and not better. What effect gives us the fuel saving? It's always part load operation. So let's start thinking as an engineer. We require a certain power for a required speed of the car, yes? In order to do this, we have to burn a given amount of fuel. If we want to achieve a lean mixture, we have to add more air, yes? What should we do to add more air? We can open the throttle. We are de-throttling the engine. We are reducing the pumping losses. And this is the real point of lean mixture. This is a big benefit of the diesel engine. The mixture of the air excess ratio goes up to 6, 7, 8 because there is no throttle. The pumping losses.
So is the Atkinson cycle running on kind of this principle?
The Atkinson, if you want, maybe end of the lecture I can show it, Atkinson and Miller. It's a different effect. It's some kind of virtual variable compression ratio. It means you are building the engine with an extremely high compression ratio, let's say 16. But you are not using it for the compression, but because it would knock with the gasoline. So with the Atkinson, the intake valve is longer open. You are going down, bottom dead center. The piston starts to come up again. But some amount of the air is pushed back into the manifold due to the open valve. You do start the compression not with 1 to 16, only 1 to 12. But during expansion, you can use the whole 1 to 16 expansion ratio with thermal efficiency. So we're always speaking about compression ratio, but the only story we are interested in is the expansion. We are building the whole engine only for expansion. All other strokes are only necessary to repeat the expansion. And it's a, let's say, unlucky wording, because not the compression, but the expansion ratio will define the efficiency of the whole story. So, and with Atkinson, we realize somehow, of course, the engine will have more weight, more size, more cubic capacity, more friction. There's nothing is for free. But we can use a very, very long, high expansion ratio. And Miller is the opposite. We are closing the intake valve earlier, so we are not filling the cylinder. And after closing the intake, the piston continues to go down. It will expand a little bit and compress, but this expansion compression is a very efficient. It's no significant loss at those low temperatures and pressures. Nothing happens. Okay. And you can see, in theory, you are designing this engine, the reverse tumble moving the fuel that way, and you have lambda 0.9 at the spark plug, fantastic. So the best choice for ignition. And you have 2.5 in the outskirts of the chamber. It sounds very well. Of course, you will have an aggressive wall wetting on the piston. So it will give you a lot of hydrocarbons, a lot of soot. It's a real disaster. And typically, we have to ignite very early because this ignitable cloud will disappear very fast due to the secondary air charge motion. So it moves too fast, and it's the time is not long enough to have the spark plug at the right time. So we have a lot of secondary losses beside the big gain of this throttling. And the people wanted to introduce, it was the first attempt, wall-guided. You can see this reverse tumble, so the intake port from the other side, between the camshafts, not from the side, but from the other side. Then people tried to develop, it was a dream, an air-guided, so without wall wetting, so that the injected cloud should not touch the piston. But it was not stable enough and not reliable enough, and couldn't be done at every speed and load and temperature. And there was one attempt, the spray-guided, just to inject this injected fuel cloud in a way that the spark plug is directly in this vicinity and it can be ignited. But it has the problem that by time, due to deposits and erosion, the injector, the shape of this cloud alters, changes. And the spark plug is highly stressed because it's very hot. Then it be cooled with hot gasoline and hot again. So the thermal stress of a spark plug is very, very high. The long life of the spark plug was limited. So you have heard it already, just in order to repeat it, we can use swirl, we can use tumble, and we can use the squish areas to intensify turbulences in the combustion chamber. So the squish flow in different engines, a certain area, a certain percentage of the piston service comes very close to the cylinder head, and the air is squished out, and it shoots to the spark plug, and it mixes the chamber in the last moment. You are familiar with tumble and swirl from former lectures, yes? Okay. And now the diesel engine. Diesel fuel is far more difficult to atomize. Why? Evaporation is the second story. The atomization is the first. We start always with chopping the fuel in small.
Yeah, because of its viscosity.
Exactly. So diesel has a higher viscosity, so we need more effort to atomize it. Typically, 10 times more pressure than with gasoline. This is a very, very hard task. And the second step is the evaporation. It has a higher boiling temperature, so evaporation is slower. But we have the conflict that we have even far less time for mixture formation than for gasoline. So we have a worse fuel and shorter time. So since that, we are spending an unbelievable amount of money. In my time as an engine development engineer, 40% of the price of the state-of-the-art passenger car diesel engine was the fuel injection equipment. So 40% of every engine sold went to Bosch. A good business for them, extremely good business. So different types. At the very beginning, what do we need for atomization? We need very small orifices. So orifice or orifice, I do not know which is the right pronunciation. So very small drillings in the nozzle. And we couldn't drill, it's hardened, heat resistant hard steel, so it's not very easy to drill small drillings. So we had typically one drilling. Since that, direct injection couldn't be done in small engines because this one fuel beam went far too deep into the chamber and hit the opposed wall and the piston, and the atomization was not fine enough. So we had some secondary devices, for example, a pre-chamber, a swirl chamber, or air chambers, or many different devices. That there was the main combustion chamber, we compressed the air, for example, this Volkswagen Golf TDI, we pressed from the main chamber a significant amount of the air in this swirl chamber due to this tangential duct. It was a high air rotation speed in this small chamber. Injected the fuel, and due to this very high rotation, it was a secondary mixing effect, not only the atomization of the injector, but even this swirl helped to homogenize and atomize the fuel. And during combustion, due to this narrow duct, there was a very turbulent flow back into the main combustion chamber, which helped to burn down the soot. And there was a high amount of soot due to the rich mixture, but due to the intense turbulences, by pressing the burning mixture through the hole, we had a secondary combustion and we could burn down the most of the soot. The same with the pre-chamber, it's the same only without rotation. It was widely used by the old Mercedes engines. And at the beginning, with large engines, heavy duty ships or vessel engines and marine engines, and later on heavy trucks, started to use direct injection because the bore diameter was large enough to avoid wall wetting with the injector. And this technology developed, and we could drill smaller and smaller bores. I do not know exactly, roughly 89, 90, it was the start of passenger car direct injection with the Audi 5-cylinder. I can be proud, my former company AVLL developed it for Audi. It was an external development. It was the same size like the 1.9 Volkswagen engine with 5 cylinders. So they used it later on at Volkswagen. And it was the smallest bore diameter which could be done to that time. And later on, even with smaller nozzle drillings, it went down to 1.6, 1.5 at 4 cylinders. And the smallest one I know, it was a Fiat diesel engine, 1.2 liter direct injection. But on those nozzles, you cannot see the drillings with eyes, only with microscope. It's less than 100 microns, the diameter of the bores in hardened steel. So it's typically laser drilled and hydraulic polishing process is done to smoothen the drilling. So it's a crazy technology. So, but you can see the red flame, what does it mean? Red color in the combustion? Glowing soot. The German says Rußleuchten, so the lighting of soot. It's a special word for it. So this color can come only from soot, so wherever you see orange or red is soot formation. And you start the injection, it ignites more or less immediately, and the significant amount of the fuel is already injected into the burning flame. So it's a bad diffusion type combustion. How to do the injection? Even the mechanical devices were the most expensive parts of diesel engines because you required very high pressure and an absolutely equal control of the amount for every cylinder. So it was a big challenge to do it mechanically. And how to do this was a crazy device, this inline injection pump. If you look an old or a heavy-duty, older heavy-duty diesel engine, you will see this fuel injection pump like a small engine. It has the same number of barrels or plungers than the real engine. And the long metal line is coming out from every unit of this injector and going to the individual cylinders. And even worse, all these lines should have the equal lengths. So if the injector pump is in the front of the engine, you measure the lengths for cylinder number 4, and you will put the same length of metal tube into the engine with bends even to cylinder number 1. So you can see long lines going along the engine in order to achieve equal lengths, because there are very strong pressure waves, and the pressure waves are influencing the amount of fuel injected. In order to achieve identical volumes at every engine speed and load, we have to do the lines equally long. So how does it work? It's a mechanical injector. It has a camshaft. The camshaft has a roller tappet, because there are very high pressures. to avoid wear, it's a roller tappet. The roller tappet will push this hardened steel plunger into a cylinder. And this is the plunger magnified, you can see it. There are no gaskets or piston rings. It's an extremely narrow gap, a few microns. It's grinded polished steel both. It's a very, very expensive in the production. And now how to regulate the amount. It's very tricky. The plunger has this groove, and even a vertical groove and an angled undercut edge. So this side drilling is coming with a few bar, the feeding pump feeding the whole system with fuel. So if the plunger is down, the whole space will be filled with diesel oil. Okay, and wait. So in this very moment, the fresh fuel comes in. We want to start injection, and the very moment the upper edge of the piston closes this drilling, it will build up pressure and inject the fuel. But in the very moment this angled edge, the lower edge, reaches the lower edge of the fuel feed line, the pressure will go back through this groove into the feed line. So we have only to rotate this plunger. And if we rotate it to this position, it's idle, and this position is full load. So we can vary the injected amount along this angled edge. It's clear? And the rotation will happen with this rack and pinion solution. So that your accelerator, the pedal, is somehow linked to this this rack. And it rotates the pinion, and it will control the amount of fuel injected. Clear for everybody? It's let's say Swiss engineering, like Swiss watches, very precise machining, expensive materials, and the whole system is crazy to adjust. You can see this pinion can be moved on the plunger because you have to synchronize all the cylinders to each other. But if you synchronize it maybe at low speed, 1000 RPM, and you are measuring it at 4000 RPM, the leakage rate of the different plungers would be different. And you will have a variation of injected amounts between the cylinders. So for a perfect injection pump, you have to put similar leak down rate in plunger units and to synchronize them on a small test stand at low speed, high speed, and to try to make an average equal distribution of injected fuel. So it's half a day typically for a four-cylinder engine. And a very, very experienced mechanic to do this work. And an expensive test bench. So at the very beginning, you have to adjust the clearance in order to synchronize the start of injection. So the very point this plunger is closing the drilling. So you are starting the whole story with injection start, with a stroboscopic lamp, and the injector nozzle is in a glass cylinder, and you can see the very beginning of the injected fuel. So synchronizing the start of the injection. Next step, you will adjust, synchronize with the pinion adjustment the amounts, and at the end you will control the flyweight idle controller and the maximum speed limiter. That there are flyweight control units to regulate the idle speed of the diesel engine. And the nozzle in another science, the typical injector nozzle, there is a needle pressed with a hard spring onto this drilling. And if the fuel pressure is high enough, the pump starts to deliver, it will lift the needle and it will inject the fuel. And there were crazy technologies to reduce this amount of fuel, because after closing the nozzle, you had still some diesel in this hole, and it dripped into the chamber and caused smoke, soot emission. So there were very, very special designs how to tighten it in a way with less and less dead volume in the bottom. Very precise machining, it's extremely crazy. And The opening pressure was adjusted by shims, putting shims below the spring, which pressed the needle onto the seat, and so on. Just have a look. So is the whole injection holder and the nozzle. The nozzle is in a very special hot resistant, the heat resistant steel, and the holder is a steel design. And of course, here you have the main fuel feed line. But due to the high pressure, there is some leakage, and the leakage would fill up this space. You have a fuel return line from the top of the injector holder back into the fuel tank. You have always some circulation of the diesel fuel through the system. So this type of inline fuel pump was very expensive. You required the same number of plunger units, like the number of cylinders of the engine. So people, which is the optical appearance of this inline pump, you see like a small engine. So here are the plungers, and here are the flyweight control units, the whole mechanics. So people tried to find a solution to have just one plunger and to distribute the fuel like a spark distributor to the necessary cylinder. And these were rotodiesel and other fuel in injection type, fuel injection pumps, to have a distributor head with an angled drilling, and this angled drilling turned always to the right cylinder which should fire, and had just one high pressure unit in the middle. Large diesel engines, if you imagine a 16-cylinder railway engine, would be very crazy with those long fuel lines to every cylinder. So from the fuel injection pump to cylinder number 16, very long line, and you have to use the same line length to cylinder number 1, with many of bends, and it's crazy. So those large engines is typically using this pump line injector system. It's operated by the regular camshaft of the engine, typically an OHV design. You have a singular injector pump beside the cylinder, a short line, and the injector in the cylinder head. So this is the typical large engine design, like marine engines, railway engines, and so on. And now Mr. Piëch, Ferdinand Piëch, fought it against common rail, because he understood very well at the beginning that common rail is fantastic. We can control everything what we have done mechanically, and that is the only reason I explain you the old system. So it was a crazy job to install the fuel pump and the initial setup of the car, even in factories. And good mechanic had to work maybe 1 hour on injection pump for a Mercedes to have it in a shape that it could be sold. So common rail is far better. You have your computer, and you can individually adjust the injected fuel for every cylinder. But you have to maintain the high pressure in the common rail all the time. Means you have to rotate a fuel pump which produces 1,000, 2,000, or 3,000 bar, and it consumes a lot of energy. Since that, at low engine loads, we do not use it. The pressure is electronically controlled and is lowered for low load, because the fuel consumption would go extremely high. So it's always a trade-off between emission and fuel consumption. Which pressure do we use for in the common rail? Since that, Mr. Piëch forced the suppliers to develop his system in German Pumpedüse, a very well-known in English unit injector system. So it's the injection pump and the nozzle in one, pushed by the camshaft. And this system will only achieve the high pressure if it is necessary for the injection. And the remaining time, there is no pressure in the system. So it consumes no energy. So the energetical efficiency of the system is far better. Later on, this mechanical system was extended with a control solenoid that you had the opportunity to use an ECU and to define the amount of injection, even to have a pre-injection and main injection. It was pretty flexible. And then came common rail. There was a big fight. At the end, Volkswagen had to switch for, had to go for common rail, because Bosch had only one customer, and there was a very expensive development necessary because the diesel particulate filter, DPF, came in. And for the DPF, you need a post-injection. And this unit injector operated by the camshaft, you can control it with a solenoid, but you need a forward motion of the plunger for pre-injection, main injection, maybe late injection. But for a diesel DPF regeneration, you need a very late post-injection. And in that time, the plunger is not more moving forward. It's coming back. So there were ideas, there was technical potential, but Bosch refused at the end to develop it for just one customer. So the business risk was too high. They stopped the development of the unit injector, and Volkswagen had to change the philosophy, and they are using common rail as well since that. It was the death of an idea. It was expensive, of course. So, and common rail, very simple fuel tank. You have an electric fuel pump. You have a high pressure mechanical pump, typically on the cylinder head. It puts the pressure into the common rail, and you have individual injectors, solenoid or piezo type, injecting the fuel into the cylinders. And of course, we have a return line and all the story. How does it work? An electromagnetic injector. With gasoline, it's pretty easy. The solenoid is strong enough that you have in case of port injection, you have a fuel pressure of 3 bar, is nothing. So you have the small needle pressed with a spring onto the seat, and the solenoid can lift it, and you can inject the fuel. With diesel, just imagine you have 1,000 or 2,000 bar in the rail. Imagine the spring force you need to keep the needle tight, an extremely high force to avoid lifting of the needle by the fuel pressure. So this force could be made with a huge solenoid, but this huge solenoid is so heavy that you cannot accelerate it, and it consumes an unbelievable amount of electric energy. So it will not work. So you need a better idea. And this better idea is a servo valve, widely used in the industry in process control. Just have a look. The high pressure is coming in, is going down, and tries to lift the needle, but there is a small orifice and is going to the upper side of the needle, which has a larger surface than the lower one. So the higher the pressure, the needle is more and more tight. So you need some spring force to have it initially tightened, but at the end, the fuel pressure will force it more and more onto the seat. No opening. And what happens? This is a very small calibrated orifice. So we are lifting this small solenoid, only controlling this very small drilling. It releases the pressure on the top side, and now the high pressure can lift the needle. And we can repeat it if we need a pre-injection. We lift it only a short time, we are putting back the pressure, the fuel pressure closes it again, and we have a second pre-injection, and then the main injection is coming. So we can control it with the computer. Not as fast like the piezo one, you will see it later, but it's pretty widely used. It's still, I do not know, more than half of diesel engines are using the solenoid type injector. The new development was the piezo. You know, the lighters and everything. If you press a piezo crystal, it produces some electricity. And other way around, if you are putting a voltage on a piezo crystal, it will change its length. So you are putting a whole staple of piezo crystals, one on the other. You are putting a high voltage on it, and it will elongate. And in the lower part of the injector, I do not know, it's not to see, there is a membrane, and you are pushing down the outer diameter of the membrane, and it pulls up the middle. And it pulls up the needle. It's like a clutch membrane spring. So you have to change the direction of the motion. So the crystals are getting longer. They are pushing down the outer diameter of this strong steel membrane. And it's pulling up the needle in the middle. So the big benefit is far faster. It's extremely fast. It's only small amount of electrical charge flowing through the system because the crystals are insulating. So there is no current flowing through, it's just an amount of electrical charge going in and out. And it looks like this. If you have the solenoid valve, solenoid has his inductive resistance. So you start with a very high voltage to force the current as fast as possible to higher figures. You need a high current to start the motion because at the very beginning there is a large air gap in the solenoid between the spoil and the iron. So it starts the moving. It is now open. You can reduce the current by controlling the voltage, only to keep it open. It's a lower force is enough and lower current. But all the time, current is flowing through the device. So we are consuming electrical energy. The piezo one, you are putting on the voltage, but it's an insulator, so some charge is going into the crystals. And since they are insulating, no more current flows. And at the end, it comes back. Okay, it's typically lost, we cannot use it, but the amount of current we consumed is far, far better. Of course, as ever in life, it's more expensive and so on, but energetically it's far more efficient as it's faster. So with a piezo injector, you can have two pre-injections, two or three main injection, one late and one post or split. You can open and close it anytime. It's extremely fast and consumes little energy. So, and the last device we need in a diesel engine is the glow plug, because compression ignition, but it works typically well if the engine is already warm. If you want to start the diesel engine at minus 20 or 40, at the end of the compression, you will not have enough temperature because all the cold metal surfaces cannot heat up the, or they are cooling down the compressed air. So it will not work. So we have a glow plug. Earlier, it was a tungsten spiral in the pre-chamber or swirl chamber, fragile and often failed. And today is a capsuled metal or ceramic tip. There is an extremely aggressive heating strategy and is controlled by the thermostat. So earlier you have to wait maybe at minus 10 C, you had to wait 30 seconds. You turn the key, a lamp went on and signalized to activate the starter motor after 10 seconds, 20 or 30. Today it's not necessary because in a few seconds, the tip of this glow plug is hot. The current would be too high, it would burn if you are continuing with the current. But then built-in small thermostat is controlling the current and keeping it on roughly 1000 C. It will help you to ignite the fuel of the first injection. Here you can see the old type. Just imagine this story in the combustion chamber. And engineers are not always so stupid. If you want to realize it with a 12 volt voltage, like usual in a car, this tungsten file is very thin and is fragile and maybe broken and due to engine vibration. So typically, all engines switch them serially. So every device uses just one fourth of the voltage, so 3 volt instead of 12. With 3 volt, you can make it thicker and more resistant against vibration and heat. The bad news, if one of them is broken, none of them will glow. But it was the usual. And let's say old cars had typically a 6 volt system on board, and it was not money saving or missing knowledge, but it was because the early light bulbs, 12 volt bulbs, were too sensitive against vibrations of the car. 6 volt, due to the thicker wire, can survive more vibration. Of course, 6 volt is very bad for the starter motor, because you need very high current due to the low voltage. So extreme amount of copper in the starter motor. Injection spray. So it's less than 100 micron in the meantime. It's very hard to machine them. We combine the whole story with the swirl. And in order to achieve swirl, in case of two valve engines, it was easy due to the tangential position of the intake port. Later on, it was increased with this special shape. And today, with four valve engines, we are using very, very special design solutions. And now, the last slide of the regular presentation. Hydrogen is in investigation and in research because of the fuel cell. But people realized if we had green hydrogen at the filling station, we can build a pretty good combustion engine with hydrogen. And in terms of total cost of ownership, it is still better than the fuel cell. So all the main truck companies has already developed hydrogen engine, and they are waiting for the appearance of hydrogen at the filling station. So they are ready. Bosch is ready for volume production of the injectors. Let's see, what is the benefit of hydrogen? No CO2 emission, if it is green hydrogen. No soot, no CO, no unburnt hydrocarbons. What is the only emission which occurs? Nitrous oxides, yes. And if we are going to lambda 1, it's heavy. But we learned in the meantime that if we increase the air-fuel ratio roughly to 2.3 to 2.5, there's nearly no NOx. So it would mean Euro 6 can be fulfilled without catalyst. And for Euro 7, we need an SCR system. But hydrogen and SCR together would produce today roughly 1/5, 1/6 of the targeted Euro 7 level. So we are far on the safe side. It is, let's say, not only Euro 7 which can be fulfilled, even the so-called zero-impact vehicle can be fulfilled with hydrogen combustion engine. So it's still an open question. If the fuel cell guys can reduce the price significantly, they could be competitive, but they are not yet. And of course, we have the proven technology in the supply chain, all the recycling issues. So with the hydrogen IC engine, heavy duty trucks are still in discussion. That's a new technology. And as always, we do not know what happens. Okay. The control questions. Why do we operate gasoline engines at lambda 1? The only reason. Earlier, with carburetors even with injection, we had the opportunity at part load to use the lowest fuel consumption and full load to use the maximum power. So it was very, very good. But it couldn't be continued. What are the possible mixture formation methods for SI engines? Sorry, historically. What devices have we used in history for mixture formation for SI engines? At the beginning, it was the... your lawnmower on chase, who has it today? Mixture formation. How do you put the gasoline in? It's a carburetor, yes. All the engines worked with carburetors. In World War II, the Daimler engine of the Messerschmitt 109 was a direct injection engine. And it has a special benefit in one special situation in dogfight. The Spitfire was flying all the time with the carburetor. And it was compensated for every acceleration And aircraft is typically better than a car because it has no side acceleration because it's tilted in the turn. But if you are pushing the stick, you have negative G. In case of negative G, the fuel is coming up in the flow chamber and you will have an extremely rich mixture, and they misfired and lost power if you had to push the stick. So the pilots typically do not push the stick because the negative G is the worst. If you are pulling it and you have very high G-forces, it starts to be gray and at the end black, and you are not more conscious, but you are still alive. If you are pushing the stick with negative G, everything in your sight starts to get rosa, then red, and if the overpressure is too much, something is broken in the tubing and you are dead. It's far more dangerous to push the stick. So if a pilot wants to lose height or altitude very rapidly, he always turns his machine and pulls the stick. But in a dogfight, sometimes you have no time. If you see already the light ammunition above, you will push the stick. And in the very moment, all the Spitfires went into misfiring and slowed down. So it was the chance for the German pilot. So it was the only benefit with the direct injection. And in the 50s, Mercedes SL with the famous doors had a direct injection inline six as well. But it was very rare, and it was a mechanical system, very, very conventional. So to that time, from the very beginning till to the 70s, were all the cars with carburetor. In the 70s, injection started, port fuel injection, typically, at the beginning central, and then later port fuel injection. In the 90s, the direct injection took over, and today it's nearly only direct injection. How does the carburetor work? How do you invite the fuel into the barrel of the carburetor? No, there is no injection pressure. You have a Venturi in the carburetor. The Venturi will increase the speed. Increased speed means static pressure goes down and it sucks the fuel from the float chamber into the barrel. Okay. The positioning, the float chamber on which side of the barrel, why is it important? Acceleration, deceleration, and cornering will influence the mixture. Okay. Single point injection and multi point. What was the use of the single point injection? We introduced it because? Yes, but what was the, let's say, the direct motivation to use injection instead of carburetor? We had to control it with the HEGO sensor, the exhaust oxygen sensor, with the lambda sensor, and it was easier with this single point injector than with the carburetor, and cheaper. It was the main argument, it was cheaper. Okay, it was not explained. You can see earlier roadgong engines with single point injection or even with port fuel injection have the intake manifold, the plenum, and the throttle valve is at the entry of the plenum. So we have huge volume from the throttle valve to the cylinders. If you look at a motorbike, you have single carburetors directly on the cylinder head, and all the throttle valves are very close to the cylinder. If you have seen yesterday this more or less racing engine of the Lada, there were single throttle valves for every cylinder and no plenum between throttle valve and cylinder. Why is it so useful? What? Just imagine what happens. You are running a racing engine with long openings of the cams at part load or idle. Throttle is nearly closed and you have a huge volume behind the throttle. If the throttle is closed, you have 600 millibar depression in the system. So very, very low absolute pressure. And due to the long valve overlap of high performing engines, you will pull back a lot of exhaust gas into the plenum. So the next cycle might misfire. It's completely overfilled with exhaust gas. And the whole engine is sends flames out on both sides and misfiring and is not running properly. If you put the throttle valve close to the intake valve, you can fill only this little volume between intake valve and throttle valve with exhaust gas. And the next cycle, enough fresh air will go in, and the engine will run smoothly even at idle and low load. So all road-going engines with long cam events require single throttles, and since that motorbikes, because they're typically high-performance engines, have always individual throttle bodies for the cylinders. Okay. In road-going cars with injection, for example, the first BMW M3 had individual throttle bodies for the cylinders. Okay. Okay, stratified mixture. We mentioned already some advantages and disadvantages. We want to try to summarize it. What was the motivation to use stratified mixture? Okay, but how? There are several steps to come to this idea. You want to reduce fuel consumption, you want to run a lean mixture in order to de-throttle the engine. But the lean mixture cannot be ignited with the spark. So since that, you need stratified to have a rich mixture at the spark plug and a very lean one far away from the spark plug. And this was the motivation to try to stratify the mixture always right. Sorry, just a moment. Szia, Viki, még tanítok, visszahívhatlak később? Nem gond. De lehalkítottam, csak oké, okay, hello, szia. Okay. The drawbacks are due to the direct injection, we started to produce soot. Due to the wall wetting, even hydrocarbons. And at the end, we required a very expensive Lindox strap, which will increase the fuel consumption. Because in order to regenerate the Lindox trap, we have to burn fuel. So we cannot use continuously the lean mixture. Okay. What are the benefits of secondary air charge motion? Why do we use it? What is the task or the purpose to generate turbulences in the chamber? Better mixture formation, yes, is the one. And the other one? To speed up the combustion, to initiate turbulent or flame front or other name is deflagration. To speed up the reaction. Yes, very good. What type of secondary air charge motion are used in spark ignition and compression ignition engines today? And which one is which one? Diesel is using more or nearly only. Tumble is the horizontal rotation of the air. Swirl, the vertical axis. You have this central bowl in the piston. It's half or one third of the diameter of the bore. All the air is pressed into this small diameter as it's rotating extremely fast even in top dead center. This is the swirl. And typically the four-valve gasoline engines are using, due to the angled position of the intake ports, it starts to rotate that way, and this is the tumble. Okay, it's not so interesting. Oh, what was the biggest issue with these inline injection pumps?
It was hard to set up.
you could never guarantee an equal injection amount at every speed and load. It was always different. So there was a tolerance, and you played around on the test bench, so it was crazy. And of course, it was expensive. Compare the Pumpedüse and common rail injection system, so unit injector and common rail, advantage, disadvantage, pros and cons. Was the main benefit of unit injector? Okay, at the end it was not cheaper. So the main argument was that it provides the high pressure only for the time of the injection. And it's not necessary to maintain it all the time for the next cycle. So the energy consumption. So the power consumption of the high pressure pump is huge for the common rail. The Pumpedüse consumes far less energy, produces less friction. Okay. Con, okay. There was one customer and nobody wanted to continue development for one customer. So Bosch requires at least two customers for such a very expensive development. And you can see the end result. Bosch has, let's say, free money, roughly $180 billion today. So they are prepared for any new development. They have strategical opportunities to invest money if necessary. And Volkswagen has roughly $200 billion debt. So it's the difference in government or management of the two companies. Okay. The electromagnetic and the piezo injector, how do they work and what are the benefits and pros and cons? Piezo is faster. Energy consumption consumes far less electrical energy, yes. But it's more expensive. The solenoid is cheaper. Let's say the main source of energy for the operation of the needle is not the solenoid, it's the fuel itself. The fuel pressure will move the needle. It's a so-called servo valve. So we are controlling only a small bypass with the solenoid. Okay. And the glow plugs, how do they work today? It's not more a simple tungsten wire, but it's ceramic or steel capsulated. But the main issue, it has a thin wire, and since the capsulation, it will not be broken. This typically in some kind of quartz scent, so safe against vibrations. But if you are putting continuous current on it, it will melt. So in order to heat it up very fast, it has too much power. And in the very moment it reaches the 1000 C roughly, you will control the current in order to avoid damage. So in a few seconds you have the peak temperature, you will keep it continuously with an electronic control. Okay. So that's it more or less with mixture formation. I cannot imagine that you have no questions. Yes?
You said that we need a turbulent flow for better mixture. I agree
with
that.
It's a benefit, yes.
But yesterday, Mr. Hanoshi said that...
It was a wrong wording from his side. What he meant, I can show it. Let's say if you have the entry of the carburetor and you want that the air goes in. What will happen? air will come from the side as well, because there is less pressure. And they are coming from the side because the flow separation in this area. And the real cross section we are using is narrower than the geometrical opening. It's the so-called Borda loss. Borda is the name of a scientist. The Borda loss. So since that, we are doing this bell mouse. If we are doing this bell mouse, the flow will not separate, and we can use the whole cross section. So it's a laminar turbulent was the wrong wording. So thank you for the question. It's very, very important. If you make an excursion at the Danube, northwest from Dürr, there are some low bridges where the water is flowing between the pillars, and you can see this extreme loss of flow. There are huge turbulences at the entry. So the water is coming from the side and flows that way. And the shape of this bell mouse, it was always a science in race engine engineering. See? Okay, good question. Yes? The mechanical, the rotating plunger. Okay. I can show it. Okay, this one.
Yes.
So, there is a grinded plunger, hardened steel, through hardened steel, extremely hard, and a few micron of gap. So it's more or less tight in the cylinder. The plunger will be moved upward with the cam lobe and downward with a spring, like a valve, more or less. It's very, very similar. Here's a groove, a vertical groove, and a horizontal one. This lower edge is angled. Then if you rotate the plunger through this rack and pinion, there is a flat part of the plunger, and it's synchronized with this pinion, and you can rotate it. This position now is full load, the maximum amount of injection. If you rotate it a little bit to the left, counterclockwise, this angled edge, well, let's say the middle of this one, will open the backflow during the upward stroke. It means the injection stroke will be shorter. The very moment this lower edge leaves the lower edge of the bore, you have no more pressure. It comes back from the top through the groove into this hole. And typically, what I told is a little cheating, because this lowest part is not full load. It is the starting amount. For cold start, you need the highest amount of fuel. And typically, as the engine starts and speeds up, the injection pump will rotate it back a little bit. And there is a mechanical safety device to avoid amounts higher than full load, because it would give you overloading of the engine or black smoke. So the full load is somewhere there, and idle is at the very higher edge of this groove. It's better now? So it's a very, very tricky device. Sometimes you have this feeding hole from both sides, but doesn't matter. This is the control edge. And as Euro 3 was introduced, people still tried to improve these plungers in a way that they made the diameter slightly reduced in a 3D surface by microns to create artificial leakage depending on engine speed and load. So they could vary and shape the injection by leakage on purpose with the plunger. But it was crazy. So the common rail was absolutely necessary to have the full control above diesel combustion. And even with ECU, it's a crazy work. I mentioned it is done 24/7 on a fully computer controlled dyno, because you have such a high degree of freedom, pre-injection, post-injection, split main injection, EGR, boost pressure, everything together, and the timing of the injection, of course, all these together give you a variety that you cannot control it with the human brain. Design of experiment, the DOE system, was always used for that complexity. So it's that the mapping of diesel is typically computer controlled. The mapping of gasoline is very easy.